Go ahead and open them to Genesis chapter 46. If you don't have a Bible, there should be a blue pew Bible in and around you. Love for you to follow along with us, and you'll find Genesis 46 on page 39. So we're in week 10 of our sermon series, kind of hard to believe, our sermon series behind the scenes, and this morning we kind of begin our descent towards the end of this series. We have just 3 weeks remaining, and we're going to start picking up the pace. We're going to cover 2 chapters this week and next week before wrapping up this series on Palm Sunday, which is just 3 weeks away. And I was struck while preparing for this series that this kind of so-called story of Joseph, which we have found is about way more than just Joseph, but this story, it hit its climax last week in chapter 45, and yet there's still 5 chapters left in this story. There's still 5 chapters to bring things to a resolution, and I just find it interesting that these 5 chapters rarely get any attention. Like, they rarely get taught or kind of really talked about or even read. And when you consider this story, you just think about the story of Joseph, even before this series, whenever you think of Joseph, you think about really 2 things. You think about just like what got him to Egypt, like the buildup to the story, and then you think about the climax. The climax that we saw last week when he finally reveals himself to his brothers, but then you never really hear about what happens afterwards. It's like hiking. Right now we're in springtime. It's supposed to be getting warmer. I'm still wearing a sweater, not happy about it, but we're supposed to be getting some warm weather soon, and I know we got some hiking enthusiasts in this room, and so if you're just thinking about a big hike you have planned for months, and you go into it, what do you think about before going into that big hike? You typically think about the grind going up the mountain, what that's like, and then getting to the top, you've reached the peak, but then we very rarely think about the trip back down. In fact, I was talking to the staff this week in our meeting, and I got to give Ilya credit because he told me this. I didn't come up with this on my own. If it's wrong, you could deal with him. But he had said with Everest, climbing Mount Everest, the majority of the deaths that happen on Mount Everest happen on the way down. On some level, I'd have to think that it's because they let their guard down. When they think about climbing Everest, the tallest mountain in the world, they think about the trek up, they think about getting to the top, but then they just don't really think much about going back down, and that's where the majority of the deaths occur. Now, I don't know why I'm relating that to a Bible story about listening to a sermon series, but let's not let our guard down on the way down from this story, because I think God has much to teach us, and we have much to learn and apply about a sovereign God who is constantly at work in and amongst his people. A sovereign God who did send Joseph to Egypt, where he spent 13 years in slavery and prison before rising to power, and being the one through whom the rest of the family would be provided for in a severe famine. So last week, we were at the top of the mountain. We saw an emotional Joseph reveal his identity to his brothers, the very ones who sold him into slavery 22 years earlier. And we just parked ourselves in the first 15 verses of chapter 45 last week and just saw his unwavering trust in a God at work. And we just marveled at it. Top of the mountain. When he said, "You sold me, brothers, but God sent me." A line that will keep you up at night if you really try and think about it. You sold me, but God sent me. The sovereignty of God will constantly and always be the source of our worship and the source of our comfort, that he is always at work in our lives and he never takes a day off. He never takes his hand off the wheel. He never takes his hand off the plow. And so now we shift gears to what happens on the descent, the resolution of this story. And last week, just due to time, I couldn't preach for 4 hours straight, so I couldn't go through all of chapter 45 like I would have liked. But basically what happened is Joseph gets permission from Pharaoh. He gets the green light to have the entire family come down. So they're up in the land of Canaan, and he gets permission from them to bring them down to Egypt. And not only does he give them the green light, but he sends the brothers home with an abundance of riches to make that trip more bearable. So he gives them wagons and food and provision. And then the story shifts to Jacob, the patriarch of this family, the father of these 12 brothers, who at this point has no idea what's happened down in Egypt. So for a moment, just put yourself in Jacob's shoes. all of his sons, including his youngest and most cherished son, Benjamin, have been sent down to Egypt to get more food. He is left with their children and their wives, just trying to keep them alive from starving. And for a number of reasons, there's no guarantee that they will return. So think about this. Every son is gone. If something happens to all of them, now there's nobody to carry on the family name, God's promise. And so he's at home for months, just morning after morning, waking up, making some watered-down coffee, eating some old stale grain that he has to ration out amongst the family because there's not a lot to go around. And day after day, he's just looking at that same spot on the horizon, hoping to see something. Hoping to see something. And he's probably expecting the worst. We were told he's old at this point. He's pretty much just waiting to die. Nothing to live for anymore. Completely depressed. But then one morning, he sees something. On the horizon, he sees a lot of something. It's a fleet of wagons and donkeys filled with food and provision, and lo and behold, all 11 of his sons are there. But before he can ask any questions, like, what the heck happened down there? Did you guys steal this? What's going on? Do you have an army behind you? Is this a joke? Before he can ask any questions, they say to him, Joseph is alive. And he goes numb. Like, wasn't expecting that. So we'll put it in perspective. It's 2017, right? Let's say you lost a child that disappeared in 1995. For 22 years, been dealing with this, and now somebody comes back to you in 2017 and say, they are alive, and not only that, they are thriving. So pack up, pops. We're going down to see them. That's what happens to Jacob in chapter 45. And so now as we shift gears to look at 46 and 47, the focus is squarely on Jacob. This father who God has also renamed Israel. And you're going to find as we read it, Moses goes back and forth calling him Jacob and Israel. And you're kind of like, why is he just not pick one name and stick with it? And we don't know yet why, but I think we're getting implications that this Israel is going to live far beyond Jacob's name. And now we get to see this father who's kind of lingered over this story but really hasn't been involved. Now there's three scenes we're going to look at today, three scenes in particular that tell us much about the God behind the scenes, the God behind the scenes who's guiding this story towards its end. So join me as I read chapter 46. We're going to start with verses 1 through 7. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Verse 5. Then Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, their little ones, their wives, in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they had gained in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons, with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his offspring he brought with him into Egypt. First scene, God assures Israel. God assures Israel. These verses contain God's only direct dialogue in this whole series. So we're walking through this 14 chapters across about 12 weeks. We hear God speak once, and it's right here. Interesting that there's one time that Moses decides to record God speaking, and it happens right here, the only time. And the reason is to give direct assurance to Jacob that, listen, this is part of the plan. Because let's think about it. Jacob had to have some reservations about this decision he was making. He had to have some doubt about the fact that now he's being called to take his whole family and move out of this land that he's been called to, that his ancestors had been called to, that God promised first to Abraham, his grandpa, then to his dad, Isaac, and now to him. And this would be the land that God would have for his people. And now he's being told, okay, take up everything and just leave. And so there had to be, of course there had to be some kind of doubt in him. It was a big decision. And even as he sets out, you can kind of get the idea that, oh no, I think I just made a wrong decision here. Like if you think about, what's the last big life decision you've made? What's the last kind of life-shaping decision you've made? Maybe it's what college to go to, who you should marry, which job and career path you should pursue, where you should live. Kind of these life-shaping decisions, I think we can all resonate with the fact that even when we make them, we're kind of, as we're going, oh no, I don't know if that was the right decision. I think I might have just made a big mistake. Unless I'm alone in that, maybe I'm alone in that. But I think there's some doubt that we have when we make kind of these like decisions that you know it just kind of changes the course of your life. Like, I'm not sure about this. So Jacob, on his way to Egypt, he stops at a place called Beersheba. It's only 26 miles south of where he set out from. So it's really relatively short. And he stops and he makes a sacrifice to the Lord. It's like once you get below Beersheba, you're out of the land. So he stops here and he just wants to kind of think about this a little bit. And he stops and he makes a sacrifice. Despite how desperate he is to get to Egypt to see Joseph, he just has to stop and think about this. And up to this point in the Bible, every sacrifice that has been made was meant to symbolize one's offenses to God and one's hope in forgiveness. That's what every sacrifice meant. My offenses to God, to confess them and to hope in forgiveness. And so by just doing this, we see evidence of a renewed, vibrant desire in Jacob to seek out the Lord. One that's been missing for a long time. And while I don't have time to recount all that's happened in Jacob's life, but we know a lot about it. It started being recorded in Genesis 26. Let's just say it's safe to say it's complicated. His relationship with God is complicated. It's gone through all different stages and seasons that were up and down, a complete roller coaster where his heart was hardened and he fled from the Lord. And then he moved through a stage of literally wrestling with the Lord, fighting for control that he thought he had because he amassed all these riches and power and land. And he's literally wrestling with the Lord. And then he goes through a time of losing it all. Being brought to his knees where he could do nothing but just with open hands submit his trust to the Lord. And now, with this sacrifice, maybe you could say for the first time in his life, Jacob is walking by faith. And I'm sure I am not alone in here this morning testifying to the truth of walking through different stages of life when it comes to God. Running from him. Wrestling with him, being brought to your knees and submitting to him, and then walking by faith. Maybe you're in one of those categories this morning where you are trying to run from him and he just won't go away. Or you are trying to wrestle from him and gain control that you want, where you have been brought low into your knees and need to submit, where maybe by God's grace you are walking by faith. We have all four represented in this room. And be rest assured, God never fails to bring his chosen people to himself. So as a result of this sacrifice, God speaks and God affirms and God assures. And he says, I am God and I have a word for you. Like, I love that he decides to state who he is before he talks. Like, as if to say, like, listen up. I am God. I have a word from you. Think about the most famous person that you would ever like to talk to. A lot of times you see a viral video of like an athlete or a celebrity like calling a nobody like me or you on the phone. And like you see the person like answer like hello. And they're like, hey, this is Derek Jeter from the Yankees, right? And they just like explode. And that person stated who they are. And because they stated who they are, it changes everything. Now that normal, Joe Schmo Yankee fan is going to remember every single word of that conversation because it was Derek Jeter that was speaking to him. And just as a sidebar, when God says, I am God, I got a word for you. What would happen if every time you opened your Bible? What would happen if every time I opened my Bible, we heard an audible voice saying, "I am God. I got a word for you"? I think we'd read our Bibles a little bit more. I think we'd be wowed by this a little bit more if we truly thought the God of the universe was speaking to us, and yet he is in his word. I am God, the God of your fathers. Wow. So God says, "Jacob, go to Egypt. I will make your family into a great nation, and I myself will go down with you." And so this is where I think the descent of this story is important, is that we're forced to kind of zoom out and realize that this whole story we're going through, it's not in a vacuum. It's not just a cool short story that we can learn a few good things from, but that it is a chapter in a larger story. It is merely a chapter in the larger story of the Bible. And when we're able to kind of zoom out and see the purpose of the story, how it connects to what happened before it, how it connects to what happened after it, I think we will be edified and blessed by that. And so him telling Jacob, "Hey, go to Egypt. You're in the promised land. I'm taking you and telling you to go to Egypt." Like, that's a little confusing. And yet it's the fulfillment of God's words to Abraham back in Genesis 15. We're going to have it up on the screen. This is Genesis 15, verse 13. "Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Jacob taking his family out of Canaan and into a foreign land, that's not plan B. That's not God changing his mind. This is the fulfillment of God's plan that has never changed. And so Jacob walks by faith. He leaves the land. And he doesn't see the whole picture. I don't think he really understands what's going to happen. But he goes ahead and he brings his small family of 70 men, women, and children in total. And while I think he thought, they're just going to go ride the famine out. Let's just go ride this famine out, and then we'll come back into the land. It doesn't end up that way. In fact, the nation of Israel will not come back into the land for 430 years. And so I wanted to show you something before we move on, to show how this fits into the bigger picture of the Bible. You don't have to turn there, but in Numbers chapter 1, after the Exodus, right, the famous Exodus where Moses leads Israel across the Red Sea out of Egypt, 430 years after this fact, God orders them to take a census. He goes, "Hey, let's take a roll call. I want a head count. Count as many men over the age of 20 that you have." So just men over the age of 20, do a head count. Numbers chapter 1, they do it, and it comes to 603,550 men over the age of 20. Which means this family of 70, starving family, on their last legs, when you include women and children, had grown to probably around 1.5 million people in 430 years. Talk about a baby boom. God fulfilled his promise to Jacob. God told him, "I'm going to bring you to Egypt, and I'm going to make a great nation out of you there." And he took this small, starving family and he turned them into a great nation. So before we move on, church, let's be comforted in this, that God never fails to fulfill his promises. He is always working. And what we now see in part, we one day will see in full. He is faithful. Let's listen to him. Let's keep going. Let's keep walking by faith. Let's move on, and we're going to skip down to verse 28 of chapter 46, and we're going to read a chunk here. We're going to go through verse 12 of 47, so hang with me. Starting verse 28 of chapter 46. "He had sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to show the way before him in Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. Israel said to Joseph, 'Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive.' Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Chapter 47, verse 1. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, my father and my brothers with their flocks and herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan. They are now in the land of Goshen. And from among his brothers, he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? And they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, as our fathers were. They said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. And now, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them settle in the land of Goshen. And if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. Verse 7. Then Joseph brought in Jacob his father and stood him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojourning. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them the possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. Second scene, God humbles Israel. God humbles Israel. There is a lot in the verses we just read, but a common thread I want us to track is the humility we see in Jacob that we have not seen before. Another sign of clear evidence of transformation that God performed in his heart, a clear sign that God does a work in anybody's heart, is humility. A humble heart. So as they get close to Egypt, Jacob sends Judah ahead to let Joseph know they're coming. Right, so Joseph piles into his chariot. You know Joseph, right? Probably a nice new model just off the assembly line. All the bells and whistles, right? Piles into his chariot. And he wants to show Dad, not only am I alive, but I've made something of myself down here. And he goes and he meets Dad halfway. And we see father and son reunite after 22 years. And I love how the text just says, and they embraced for a good while. They embraced for a good while. This wasn't a handshake, Father. This wasn't an awkward side hug, right? Where it's, we can agree, we can all just do away with for the rest of our lives. Like, no one ever benefits from a good side hug, okay? So this wasn't an awkward embrace. This was full on holding you for a good while. 22 years worth. And Jacob, upon seeing his son again, proclaims in his old age, that's all I needed. I just needed to see you and hold you, and I can die now. You kind of get the idea that Israel was on his last legs. He doesn't die right away, but he doesn't know that yet. He just gives God permission. He says, take me now. That's all I needed to see. If you know your Bible really well, that should ring a bell. That scene should ring a bell because we see that again somewhere. This past Christmas Eve, I spoke about an old man named Simeon that the writer Luke decides to write about in his gospel. He's the only one in all the gospels who decides to write about this old man. He just seems kind of like a literally a random old man who God chose to bestow his spirit upon and tell him, listen, you're going to see the Messiah, which is a massive promise. God hasn't spoken in 400 years, and this old man says, you're going to see the Messiah before you die. So he just faithfully keeps going to the temple, assuming, I guess I'm going to see him there. I don't even know where he's coming from. Things are so messed up right now in Israel. The Pharisees are off the reservation. But I'm being told I can see the Messiah. And one day he walks in and he sees this baby, 40 days old. And the Spirit affirms to him, there's the Messiah. And so he takes him into his arms in a scene that other people probably saw and they're like, this is weird. What is going on? But he takes him into his arms. And Luke 2:29, we read this. He says, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation that you have prepared in the presence of your peoples. Translation, I can die now. You've allowed me to see him. Joseph proves to be a precursor that is meant to point to Jesus. This whole story, every single scene is meant to point to Jesus. Not learn just something from Joseph, but to point to Jesus Christ. Jesus, who also was rejected by his own people and left for dead. Before God raised him up and put him in an exalted position to be the one who provides for the very people who rejected him. Unbelievable. The Bible is pretty wild. One cohesive story. We need to read our Bibles more. This whole thing is just God at work over and over again. So Jacob is humbled by the gift he's given in seeing his son again. But after their long embrace, Joseph has some work to do. Because he's got to go before Pharaoh and ensure that now his family can settle in some good land. So he starts prepping his brothers. Okay, this is how you got to go before Pharaoh. Right? It's like a job interview prep. Right? Like this is the question. This is how you should answer it. And he starts just giving them some preparation. And it's going to be a little difficult. Because if you notice what he said, Jacob and all his sons, they're shepherds, lifelong shepherds in the family business. And the Egyptians in their culture just happen to think of shepherding as an abomination. That's a rough start to an interview. For the Egyptians, it is beneath them. It is a dirty job that no one enjoys, and no one who does it is thought of very favorably. So you're going into this thinking, this might not go too well. But Joseph, full of integrity, which we've seen time and time again, he tells his brothers what? He says, be honest. Tell them exactly what you are. You're shepherds. You're herdsmen. And their integrity pays off because it was subtle, but did you notice what Pharaoh did when they told him? Did you notice what he said to them? It was subtle, but listen again, verse 6b. Pharaoh says, let them settle in the land of Goshen, and if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. Not only do they get land, but they get all of Pharaoh's livestock to shepherd over because nobody else wants the job. It's an abomination to anybody else. Nobody's fighting for that. So he says, you know what? You guys are shepherds? Great. Take all my livestock. Nobody else wants them. And because he gets their livestock, he gives them the best land in Egypt. So we have a map up here of what the best land would be. It'd be the land of Goshen, northern Egypt. So Israel's just off to the top right, and that's the most fertile land as the Nile flows into the Mediterranean Sea. And he says, this is the best land. In times of a famine, land and good land is hard to come by, but he gives this group of foreigners with these herdsmen, since they're Joseph's brothers and dad, he says, you go take the best land in Egypt. It's like God has this thing rigged. And then Jacob himself is brought before Pharaoh, and I need you to picture this scene. If you need to close your eyes to picture it, close your eyes. Picture this scene. You have Pharaoh, in all his glory and might, on the throne, now face to face with this old man who is just beat up. This old man who shows the signs of a long, hard life. There couldn't be more of a contrast that gets painted. They couldn't seem more different. And yet this battered-looking old man standing before this powerful world leader just so happens to be the patriarch through whom the God of the universe has promised to bless and make a great nation out of. It's this grand picture of the world's strength versus God's strength. This picture of perceptive weakness versus perceptive strength. And Pharaoh gives him a chance to boast. All right, so Pharaoh calls him before him, and to Egyptians, age and kind of what you've done to life is kind of your measuring stick of how powerful you are. The more things change, the more things stay the same. If in our day we have the same problem. And he goes, tell me about your life, Jacob. How many years do you have behind you? Right, just puts it on a silver platter for Jacob to impress and talk about his vast riches and his vast wealth. And he had the best land up north that God promised to him. He has a lot to boast about in his life. And as I'm reading this, I'm just thinking about, for us, how sad is it that this is true? That when we come across somebody we consider important, when we can come across somebody and we start dealing with somebody who we think is powerful and important, we go out of our way to try and make ourselves look important and powerful. If given even just the smallest opportunity to talk about ourselves in the presence of grand company, we jump at it because we want to be important. We want to show we belong. We want to show that we've done some things. And we should be with this person. We should be in company with this person. So Jacob gets it served to him on a silver platter, and yet he goes the other way. He says, my years have been few, and they've been hard, and they don't compare to the days of my fathers. The words of a man who is humbled, who doesn't need pop and circumstance, who has all he needs from God, that he doesn't need anything else from Pharaoh. That is amazing. When you think of what Jacob's done, that's like Michael Jordan, somebody who knows nothing about basketball, going, hey, Michael's your name? Can you tell me about your career? And then just being like, nah, not much. I ran up and down and played ball a little bit. Nothing really to write home about. That's what Jacob does in front of Pharaoh, given to him on a silver platter to boast. And he says nothing and just bestows his humble heart. So let's let Jacob be a testimony for us today, that when we rightly see and understand what it means to be connected to God, everything else in this world falls into its proper place. For someone who has received the grace of God, who has a relationship and blessing from the God of the universe, everything else should pale in comparison. And regardless of the platform we gain or the people we come before, let us say along with Jacob in the words of the Apostle Paul, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Let's not allow the world to captivate us more than the gospel. And the next line is nothing short of fascinating. After saying this, we read, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out. The lesser blessing the greater. The first shall be last. The last shall be first. The humble will be exalted and the proud will be laid low. This is all throughout the Bible. Oh, that we would have eyes to see and ears to hear this morning as we exist in a culture which is all about promoting self. All about boasting self. It is dangerous and it doesn't end well. Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Well, let's skip down to verse 27 of chapter 47 due to time. And let's see Jacob in this final scene on his deathbed. Genesis 47, verse 27. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. Verse 29. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place." He answered, "I will do as you have said." And he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. Third scene, God prepares Israel. God prepares Israel. And it's interesting to point out, in verse 27, as I see it, is the first time that the name Israel gets applied to the entire family and not just Jacob. It says, "Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt and the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly." Just the first indication that this name Israel, this God-given name Israel, is not going to die with Jacob. But it will carry forward to be the name of this family that is turning into a nation. The first indication that the God of Israel does not signify one man, but an entire people. And we'll talk more about this in the next couple of weeks, but they are together now in this land of Goshen, and they are fulfilling God's first command in the Bible. What was God's first command ever in the Bible to Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply. And they will do just that, going from 70 to 1.5 million over the next 400 years until Moses comes in and leads them out. And in these final verses, we find that Jacob doesn't die right away like he thought, but he lives another 17 years. He was truly physically revived by being reunited with his family, but eventually the time comes, his body begins to fail, and at a ripe old age of 147 years old, he's now on his deathbed. And he calls Joseph in. Joseph, who, by the way, is 59 years old right now. Like, we met this kid back when he was 17, when he was just a naive kid, this naive younger brother, and here he is at 59, ruling over Egypt and still caring for his family, especially now his bedridden father. And Jacob is afraid of dying in Egypt. He's afraid of dying outside the land. Again, the famine now is long over at this point. He thought they would be back, but they're not. They're kind of settled in into Egypt. But he goes, "I don't want to end up here. Don't let me get buried here." And I think there's a powerful truth here, that Jacob knew that these new digs, which were nice and they were favorable, they weren't home. And eventually, that well was going to run dry. And there was going to be a better future home for his people. So God uses Joseph to prepare Israel for the end and to assure him that he will do as his father requests. And so this morning we end exactly how we started. Chapter 47 ends exactly how 46 began, with God always working, assuring his people, assuring Jacob that he will be exactly where God wants him. But we're not done with Jacob just yet. Next week, we'll cover two chapters, and he's going to give blessings from his deathbed. The next two chapters are just him just handing out blessings from his deathbed to his sons and to his grandsons. This patriarch's final words to his children and his grandchildren, and there are some majorly impactful words that will reverberate and echo all across Scripture that we'll look at next week. So here we are on the hike down this mountain, on the descent. And God has some things for us. We see Jacob from a spiritual standpoint in the golden age of his life, where he is, one, walking by faith. Two, where he is humbled by all God has given him and he boasts in God alone. And three, where he prepares to move on from this world, because this world's well will run dry. And he prepares and is at peace with the fact that his home is elsewhere. There's a better home awaiting him. Let us have ears to hear this morning. Let's pray.